who was lying on an airbed which blew perfumed fumes round her thin, exposed legs. She was sitting, watching the game with a big smile on her face, and she took a while to notice the guard. Hawser walked a little faster, so that when the guard straightened he would be past her. The old lady flashed her pass and turned quickly back to the game. The guard put out an arm in front of Hawser. "May I see your pass, sir?" Hawser stopped and looked into the face of the young, burly woman. He looked back down to the couch he had been on. "I'm sorry, I think I left it down there. I'll be back in a second. Can I show it to you then? I'm in a bit of a hurry." He shifted his weight from one foot to the other and bent a little at the waist. "I got wrapped up in the last hand there. Too much to drink before the game started. Always the same. Never learn. All right." He put out his hands, looked a little sheepish, and made as if to clap the guard on her shoulders. He shifted his weight again. The guard looked down to where Hawser had indicated he had left his pass. "For now, sir. I'll look at it later. But you really shouldn't go leaving it lying about. Don't do it again." Right. Thank you." Hawser laughed and went off at a quick walk onto the circular walkway and then to a toilet just in case he was being watched. He washed his face and hands, listened to a drunk woman singing somewhere in the echoing room, then left by another exit and walked round to another terrace where he got something else to eat and had a drink. He bribed his way into a different terrace again, this one even more expensive than the one he had been on originally, because it was next to the one which held Wilgra's concubines. A soft wall of shining black material had been erected at the rear and sides of their terrace to keep out the nearer eyes, but their body scent wafted strongly over the terrace Hawser now found himself on. Genofixed before conception, not only to be stunningly attractive to a wide variety of humanoid males, the females in the harem also had highly accentuated aphrodisiac pheromones. Before Hawser knew what was happening, he had an erection and had started to sweat again. Most of the men and women around him were in a state of obvious sexual arousal, and those not plugged into the game on some sort of exotic double fix were engaged in sexual foreplay or actual intercourse. Hawser made his immune glands start up again and walked stiffly to the front of the terrace, where five couches had been vacated by two males and three females, who were rolling around on the ground in front, just behind the restraining barrier. Clothes lay scattered on the terrace floor. Hawser sat on one of the five free couches. A female head, beaded with sweat, appeared from the tangle of heaving bodies long enough to look at Hawser and breathe, "Feel free, and if you'd like to..." Then her eyes rolled upward and she moaned. Her head disappeared again. Hawser shook his head, swore, and made his way out of the terrace. His attempt to recover the money he had spent bribing his way in was met with a pitying laugh. Hawser ended up sitting on a stool in front of a combined bar and betting stall. He ordered a drug bowl and made a small bet on Craiglin to win the next hand, while his body gradually freed itself of the effects of the concubine's doctored sweat glands. His pulse lowered and his breathing shallowed. Perspiration stopped rolling down his brow. He sipped his drug bowl and sniffed the fumes while watching Craiglin lose first one and then another hand, though in the first one he pulled out early enough not to lose a life. Nevertheless, he was down to one life now. It was possible for a damaged player to gamble his own life if he had no other remaining behind him, but it was a rare thing, and in games where the very best met hopefuls, as in this one, the Ishlosin army tended to forbid it. The captain of the Clear Air Turbulence was taking no chances. He dropped out of every game before he could lose a life, obviously waiting for a hand that would be almost unbeatable before gambling for what might be the last time in the game. Hawser ate. Hawser drank. Hawser sniffed. Sometimes he tried to look over at the terrace he'd been on at first, where the bored-looking woman was, but he couldn't see for the lights. Now and again he looked up at the fighting animals on the trapezes. They were tired now and injured. The elaborate choreography of their earlier movements was gone, and they were reduced to hanging grimly onto their trapeze with one limb and striking out at each other with the other clawed arm whenever they happened to come close enough. Drops of white blood fell like sparse snow and settled on an invisible force field 20 meters beneath them. Gradually, the lives died. The game went on. Time, according to who you were, dragged or flashed by. The price of drinks and drugs and food went up slowly as the destruction time crept closer. Through the still transparent dome of the old arena, the lights of departing shuttles blazed now and again. A fight broke out between two punters at the bar. Hawser got up and moved away before the security guards came to break it up. Hawser counted his money. He had 2 Aoish credit tenths left, plus some money credited to the negotiable cards, which were becoming harder and harder to use as the accepting computers in the orbital's financial network were closed down. He leaned on a restraining bar on a circular walkway, watching the game progress on the table below. Wilgra was leading. The Suet was just behind. They had both lost the same number of lives, but the blue giant had more money. Two of the hopefuls had left the game. One, after trying unsuccessfully to persuade the officiating Ishlosin army that he could afford to gamble with his own life. Craiklin was still in there, but from the close-up of his face, which Hawser caught on a monitor screen in a drug bar he passed, the man was finding the going hard. Hawser toyed with one of the Aoish credit tents, wishing the game would end, or at least that Craiklin would get put out. The coin stuck to his hand, and he looked down into it. It was like looking into a tiny, infinite tube, lit from the very bottom. By bringing it up to your eye with the other closed, you could experience vertigo. The Aoish were a banker species, and the credits were their greatest invention. They were just about the only universally acceptable medium of exchange in existence, and each one entitled the holder to convert a coin into either a given weight of any stable element, an area on a free orbital, or a computer of a given speed and capacity. The Aoish guaranteed the conversion and never defaulted, and although the rate of exchange could sometimes vary to a greater extent than was officially allowed for, as it had during the Adiran Culture War, on the whole, the real and theoretical value of the currency remained predictable enough for it to be a safe, secure hedge against uncertain times, rather than a speculator's dream. Rumour, as ever, contrary enough to be suspiciously believable, had it that the group in the galaxy which possessed the greatest hoard of the coins was the Culture, the most militantly unmoneyed society on the civilized scene. Hawser didn't really believe that rumour either, though in fact he thought it was just the sort of rumour the Culture would spread about itself. He pushed the coins away into a pocket inside his blouse as he saw Craiklin reaching to the centre of the game table and toss some coins into the large pile already there. Watching carefully now, the changer made his way round to the nearest money changer's bar, got 800ths for his single tenth, an exorbitant rate of commission even by Vavach standards, and used some of the change to bribe his way into a terrace with some unoccupied couches. There, he plugged into Craiklin's thoughts.
"Who are you?"
The question leapt out at him, into him. The sensation was one of vertigo, a stunning dizziness, a vastly magnified equivalent of the disorientation which sometimes affects the eyes when they fasten on a simple and regular pattern, and the brain mistakes its distance from that pattern. The false focus seeming to pull at the eyes, muscles against nerves, reality against assumptions. His head did not swim. It seemed to sink, foundering, struggling.
"Who are you?
Who am I?
Who are you?"
Slam, slam, slam. The sound of the barrage falling, the sound of doors closing, attack and incarceration, explosion and collapse together. Just a little accident, a slight mistake, one of those things, a game of damage, and a high-tech impressionist. Unfortunate combination, two harmless chemicals which, when mixed, feedback, a howl-like pain and something breaking. A mind between mirrors. He was drowning in his own reflection, something breaking, falling through. One fading part of him, the part which didn't sleep. Yes, no, screamed from down the deep, dark pit as it fell. Changer! Changer! Change! The sound faded, whisper quieted, became the wind moan of stale air through dead trees on a barren midnight solstice, the soul's midwinter in some calm, hard place. He knew, start again. Somebody knew that somewhere a man sat in a seat, in a big hall, in a city, in... on a big place, a big threatened place, and the man was playing a game which killed. The man still there, living and breathing, but his eyes did not see, his ears did not hear. He had one sense now, this one, inside here, fastened, inside here.
Whisper, who am I?
There'd been a little accident. Life, a succession of same, evolution dependent on garbling. All progress a function of getting things wrong. He, and forget who this he is. Just accept the nameless term while this equation works itself out. He is the man in the chair, in the hall, on the big place. Fallen somewhere inside himself. Somewhere inside. Another one. A double. A copy. Somebody pretending to be him. But something wrong with this theory.
Start again.
Martial forces. Need clues, reference points, something to hold on to. Memory of a cell dividing, seen in time-lapse, the very start of independent life, though still dependent. Hold that image. Words, names, need words. Not yet, but something about turning inside out. A place. What am I looking for? Mind. Whose? Silence. Whose? Silence. Whose? Silence. Start again. Listen, this is shock. You were hit hard. This is just some form of shock, and you'll recover. You are the man playing the game, as are we all. Still something wrong, though. Something both missing and added. Think of those vital errors. Think of that dividing cell. Same and not same. The place that's turned inside out. The cell cluster, turning itself inside out, looking like a split brain. Unsleeping, moving. Listen for somebody trying to talk to you. Silence. This from the very pit of night, naked in the wasteland, the ice wind moaning, his only covering, alone in the freezing darkness under a sky of chill obsidian. Whoever tried to talk to me? When did I ever listen? When was I ever other than just myself, caring only for myself? The individual is the fruit of mistake, therefore only the process has validity. So who's to speak for him? The wind howls, empty of meaning, a soak for warmth, a cess for hope, distributing his body's exhausted heat to the black skies, dissolving the salty flame of his life, chilling to the core, sapping and slowing. He feels himself falling again, and knows that this time it is a deeper plunge, to where the silence and the cold are absolute, and no voice cries out, not even this one. Howled like the wind, "Whoever cared enough to talk to me?" Silence. Whoever cared? Silence. Who? Whisper. Listen. The Jinmoti of Boslin too? Two. Somebody had spoken once. He was the changer. He was the error, the imperfect copy. He was playing a different game from the other one, but he still intended to take a life. He was watching, feeling what the other was feeling, but feeling more... Hawser. Cricklin. Now he knew. The game was damage. The place was a world where a ribbon of the original idea was turned inside out. An orbital. Vavach. The mind in Shah's world. Zoralundra, Balveda. The... And finding his hate, he hammered it into the wall of the pit like a peg for a rope. Culture. A breach in the cell wall. Waters breaking, light freeing, illumination, leading to rebirth. Weight and cold and bright, bright light. Shit, bastards, lost it all, thanks to a pit of self-doubt treble. A wave of despondent fury swept over him, and something died. Hawser tore the flimsy headset away. He lay quivering on the couch, his eyes gummed and smarting, staring up at the auditorium lights and the two white fighting animals hanging half-dead from the trapezes overhead. He forced his eyes closed, then pulled them open again, away from the darkness. Pit of self-doubt. Cricklin had been hit by cards which made the target player question their own identity. From the tenor of Cricklin's thoughts before he'd pulled the headset off, Hawser thought Cricklin hadn't been too terrified by the effect, just disoriented. He'd been sufficiently distracted by the attack to lose the hand, and that was all his opponents had been aiming for. Cricklin was out of the game. The effect on him, trying to be Cricklin, but knowing he wasn't, had been more severe. That was all it was. Any changer would have had the same problem, he was certain. The trembling began to fade. He sat up and swung his feet off the couch. He had to leave. Cricklin would be going, so he had to. Pull yourself together, man. He looked down to the playing table. The breastless woman had won. Cricklin glared at her as she raked in her winnings and his straps were unfastened. On the way out of the arena, Cricklin passed the limp, still warm body of his last life as it was released from its seat. He kicked the corpse. The crowd booed. Hawser stood up, turned and bumped into a hard, unyielding body. "May I see that pass now, sir?" said the guard he'd lied to earlier. He smiled nervously, aware that he was still trembling a little. His eyes were red and his face was covered in sweat. The guard gazed steadily at him, her face expressionless. Some of the people on the terrace were watching them. "I'm Sorry, the changer said slowly, patting his pockets with shaking hands. The guard put out her hand and took his left elbow. Perhaps you'd better... Look, Horsa said, bending closer to her. I haven't got one. Would a bribe do? He started to reach inside his blouse for the credits. The guard kicked up with her knee and twisted Horsa's left arm behind his back. It was all done in the most expert fashion, and Horsa had to jump to ride the kick tolerably. He let his left shoulder disconnect and started to crumple, but not before his free hand had lightly scratched the guard's face. And that, he realized as he fell, had been an instinctive reaction, nothing reasoned. For some reason, he found this amusing. The guard caught Horsa's other arm and pinned both his hands behind his back, using her lock glove to secure them there. With her other hand, she wiped blood from her cheek. Horsa knelt on the terrace surface, moaning the way most people would have with an arm broken or dislocated. It's all right, everybody, just a little problem over a pass. Please continue with your enjoyment, the guard said. Then she pulled her arm up. The locked glove hauled Horsa up too. He yelped with pretended pain and then, head down, was pushed up the steps to the walkway. 7373, male, code green, incoming walk 7 spinwards, the guard told her lapel mic. Horsa felt her start to weaken as soon as they got to the walkway. He couldn't see any other guards yet. The pace of the woman behind him faltered and slowed. He heard her gasp, and a couple of drunks leaning on an auto bar looked at them quizzically. One turned on his bar stool to watch. 7 3, the guard began. Then her legs buckled. Horsa was dragged down with her, the locked glove staying tight while the muscles in the woman's body relaxed. He connected his shoulder again, twisted and heaved. The field filaments in the glove gave way, leaving him with livid bruises already starting to form on his wrists. The guard lay on her back on the walkway floor, her eyes closed, breathing lightly. Horsa had scraped her with a non-lethal poison nail, he thought. Anyway, he had no time to wait and see. They were sure to come looking for the guard soon, and he couldn't afford to let Craiglin get too far ahead of him. Whether he was heading back to the ship, as Horsa expected he would, or staying to observe more of the game, Horsa wanted to stay close. His hood had fallen back during the fall. He pulled it forward, then hoisted the woman up, dragged her to the bar where the two drunks sat, and heaved her onto a bar stool, putting her arms crossed on the bar in front and letting her head rest on them. The drunk, who'd watched what had happened, grinned at the changer. Horsa tried to grin back. "Look after her now," he said. He noticed a cloak at the foot of the other drunk's bar stool and lifted it up, smiling at its owner, who was too busy ordering another drink to notice. Horsa put the cloak round the woman guard's shoulders, hiding her uniform. "In case she gets cold," he told the first drunk, who nodded. Horsa walked off quietly. The other drunk, who hadn't noticed the woman until then, got his drink from the flap in the counter in front of him, turned round to talk to his friend, noticed the woman draped across the bar, nudged her and said,
"Hey, you like the cloak? How about I get you a drink?"
Before he left the auditorium, Horsa looked up. The fighting animals would fight no more. Beneath the shining hoop that was Vavatcha's far, and at the moment, dayside, one beast lay in a broad, shallow pool of milky blood, high in the air, its huge four-limbed frame, an X, poised over the proceedings beneath, the dark fur and heavy head gashed, white-flecked. The other creature hung, swaying gently from its trapeze. It dripped white blood, and twisted slowly, hanging by one closed and locked set of talons, as dead as its fallen adversary. Horsa racked his brains, but could not recall the names of these strange beasts. He shook his head and hurried away. He found the players' area. An Ishlor Sinami stood by some double doors in a corridor deep underneath the arena's surface. A small crowd of people and machines stood or sat around. Some were asking the silent Ishlor Sinami questions, most were talking among themselves. Horsa took a deep breath, then, waving one of his now useless negotiable account cards, elbowed his way through the crowd, saying, "Security! Come on, out of the way there! Security!" People protested but moved. Horsa planted himself in front of the tall Ishlor Sinami. Steely eyes looked down at him from a thin, hard face. "You," Horsa said, snapping his fingers. "Where did that player go? The one in the light one-piece suit, brown hair." The tall humanoid hesitated. "Come on, man," Horsa said. "I've been chasing that card shop around half the galaxy. I don't want to lose him now." The Ishlor Sinami jerked his head in the direction of the corridor leading to the main arena entrance.
He just left.
The humanoid's voice sounded like two pieces of broken glass being rubbed together. Hawser winced, but nodded quickly and, pushing his way back through the crowd, ran up the corridor. In the vestibule of the arena complex, there was an even bigger crowd. Guards, wheeled security drones, private bodyguards, car drivers, shuttle pilots, city police, people with desperate looks waving negotiable cards. Others listing those who were buying space on shuttle buses and hovers running out to the port area. People just hanging around, waiting to see what was going to happen, or hoping that an ordered taxi was about to show up. People just wandering around with lost expressions on their faces, their clothes torn and dishevelled. Others with smiles, all confidence, clutching bulky bags and pouches to themselves, and frequently accompanied by a hired guard of their own. They all milled around in the vast expanse of noisy, bustling space, which led from the auditorium proper to the plaza outside in the open air, under the stars and the bright line of the orbital's far side. Pulling his hood further over his face, Hawser pushed through a barricade of guards. They still seemed concerned with keeping people out, even at this late stage in the game and in the countdown to destruction, and he was not hindered. He looked over the swirling mass of heads, capes, helmets, casings and ornamentation, wondering how he was going to catch Craiglin in this lot, or even see him. A wedge of uniformed quadrupeds pushed past him, some tall dignitary carried on a litter in their midst. As Hawser was still staggering, a soft pneumatic tyre rolled over his foot as a mobile bar touted its wares.
"Would you like a drug bowl cocktail, sir?" said the machine.
"Fuck off," Hawser told it, and he turned to head after the wedge of four-legged creatures making for the doors.
"Certainly, sir. Dry, medium, or..."
Hawser elbowed his way through the crowd after the quadrupeds. He caught up with them, and in their wake had an easy passage to the doors. Outside, it was surprisingly cold. Hawser saw his breath in front of him as he looked quickly around, trying to spot Craiglin. The crowd outside the arena was hardly less thick and rowdy than that inside. People hawked wares, sold tickets, staggered about, paced to and fro, tried to beg money from strangers, picked pockets, scanned the skies, or peered down the broad spaces between buildings. A constant bright stream of machines appeared, roaring out of the sky or sweeping up the boulevards, stopped, and after taking people on, raced off again. Hawser just couldn't see properly. He noticed a huge hire guard, a 3-meter-tall giant in a bulky suit, holding a large gun and looking about with a vacant expression on a broad, pale face. Wisps of bright red hair poked from underneath his helmet. "You for hire?" Hawser asked, doing a sort of breaststroke to get to the giant through a knot of people watching some fighting insects. The broad face nodded gravely, and the huge man came to attention.
"That I am,"
the great voice rumbled. "Here's 100th," Hawser said quickly, shoving a coin into the man's glove, where it looked quite lost. "Let me up on your shoulders. I'm looking for somebody."
"All right," the man said after a second's thought.
He bent down slowly on one knee, the rifle in his hand put out to steady him, butt first on the ground. Hawser slung his legs over the giant's shoulders. Without being asked, the man straightened and stood again, and Hawser was hoisted high above the heads of the people in the crowd. He pulled the hood of the blouse over his face again and scanned the mass of people for a figure in a light one-piece suit, although he knew that Craiglin might have changed by now or even have left. A tight, nervous feeling of desperation was building in Hawser's belly. He tried to tell himself that it didn't matter that much if he lost Craiglin now, that he could still make his way alone to the port area and so to the GSV that the clear air turbulence was on. But his guts refused to be calmed. It was as though the atmosphere of the game, the terminal excitement of the orbital, the city, the arena in their last hours, had altered his own body chemistry. He could have concentrated on it and made himself relax, but he couldn't afford to do that now. He had to look for Craiglin. He scanned the gaudy collection of individuals waiting in a cordoned area for shuttles, then recalled Craiglin's thoughts about having wasted a lot of money. He looked away and surveyed the rest of the crowd. He saw him. The captain of the clear air turbulence was standing, his suit partly covered by a grey cloak, his arms folded and his feet apart, in a queue of people waiting to get buses and taxis, 30 meters away. Hawser dipped forward and leaned over until he was looking at the hire guard's upside-down face. "Thanks, you can put me down now."
"I have no change,"
the man rumbled as he stooped. The vibration went up through Hawser's body. "That's okay, keep it." Hawser jumped off the guard's shoulders. The giant shrugged as Hawser ran, swerving and ducking to get past people, toward where he had seen Craiglin. He had his terminal fastened to his left cuff. The time was -2.5 hours. Hawser squeezed and shoved and excused and apologised his way through the crowd, and on his way saw many people squinting at watches, terminals and screens, heard many little synthesised voices squawk the hour and nervous humans repeat it. There was the queue. It looked surprisingly orderly, Hawser thought. Then he noticed that it was being supervised by the same security guards who'd been inside the arena. Craiglin was near the front of the queue now, and a bus had almost finished filling up. Road cars and hovers waited behind it. Craiglin pointed at one of them as a security guard with a note screen talked to him. Hawser looked at the row of waiting people and guessed there must be several hundreds of them in it. If he were to join it, he would lose Craiglin. He looked around quickly, wondering what other way there might be of following. Somebody crashed into him from behind, and Hawser turned round to the noise of shouting and voices and a press of brightly dressed people. A masked woman in a tight silver dress was shouting and screaming at a small, puzzled-looking man with long hair, clad only in intricate loops of dark green string. The woman shouted incoherently at the small man and struck out at him with her open hands. He backed off, shaking his head. People watched. Hawser checked that he hadn't had anything stolen when he was bumped into, then looked round again for some transport or a taxi tout. An aircraft flew overhead noisily and dropped leaflets written in a language Hawser didn't understand.
"Sarabel," a transparent-skinned man said to a companion as they both squeezed out of the nearby crowd and went past Hawser.
The man was trying to look at a small terminal screen as he walked. Hawser caught a glimpse of something which puzzled him. He turned his own terminal onto the appropriate channel. He was watching what looked like the same incident he had seen for real in the auditorium a few hours earlier. The disturbance on the terrace above his own when he'd heard that Sarbel the Eye had been caught by the security guards. Hawser frowned and brought the screen on his cuff closer. It was that same place. It was that incident, seen from almost exactly the same angle and apparent distance he'd watched it from. He grimaced at the screen, trying to imagine where the picture he was watching now could have been taken from. The scene ended and was replaced by candid shots of various eccentric-looking beings enjoying themselves in the auditorium, as the damage game went on somewhere in the background. If I'd stood up, Hawser thought, and moved over just... It was the woman. The woman with the white hair he'd seen early on, standing in the highest part of the arena, fiddling with a tiara. She'd been on that same terrace, been standing by his lounger when the incident on the terrace above took place. She was Sarbel the Eye. Probably the tiara was the camera, and the person on the higher terrace was a decoy, a plant. Hawser snapped off the screen. He smiled, then shook his head as though to dislodge the small, useless revelation from the centre of his attention. He had to find some transport. He started walking quickly through the crowd, threading his way through people in groups and lines and queues, looking for a free vehicle, an open door, a tout's eyes. He caught a glimpse of the queue Craiglin was in. The cat's commander was at the open door of a red road car, apparently arguing with its driver and two other people in the queue. Hawser felt sick. He started to sweat. He wanted to kick out, to throw all the people crowding around him out of his path, away from him. He doubled back. He would have to risk trying to bribe his way into Craiglin's queue at the front. He was 5 meters away from the queue when Craiglin and the two other people stopped arguing and got into the taxi which drove off. As he turned his head to watch it go past, his stomach sinking, his fists clenching, Hawser saw the white-haired woman again. She wore a hooded blue cloak, but the hood fell back as she squeezed out of the crowd to the edge of the road, where a tall man put his arm round her shoulders and waved into the plaza. She pulled the hood up again. Hawser put his hand into his pocket and onto the gun, then went forward toward the couple, just as a sleek, matte black hover hissed out of the darkness and stopped beside them. Hawser stepped forward quickly as the hover's side door winged open and the woman, who was Sarbel the Eye, stooped to enter. Hawser reached out and tapped the woman on the shoulder. She whirled round to face him. The tall man started toward him, and Hawser shoved his hand forward and up in his pocket so that the gun pressed out. The man stopped, looking down, uncertain. The woman froze, 1 foot on the door's sill. "I think you're going my way," Hawser said quickly. "I know who you are," he nodded at the woman. "I know about that thing you had on your head. All I want is a lift to the port, that's all. No fuss." He gestured with his head in the direction of the security guards at the head of the main queue. The woman looked at the tall man, then at Hawser. She stepped back slowly. "Okay. After you."
"No, you first."
Hawser motioned with a hand in his pocket. The woman smiled, shrugged and got in, followed by the tall man and Hawser.
"What's he?"
began the driver, a fierce-looking bald woman.
"A guest," Sarble told her. "Just drive."
The hover rose. "Straight ahead," Hawser said. "Fast as you like. I'm looking for a red-coloured wheeled car." He took the gun out of his pocket and pivoted round so that he faced Sarble the Eye and the tall man. The hover accelerated.
"I told you they put that cast out too soon,"
the tall man hissed in a hoarse, high voice. Sarble shrugged. Hawser smiled, glancing occasionally out of the window at the traffic around the cab, but watching the other two people from the corner of his eye.
"Just bad luck," Sarble said. "I get bumping into this guy inside the place too."
"You really are Sarble, then?" Hawser said to the woman. She didn't look round and didn't reply.
"Look," the man said, turning to Hawser. "We'll take you to the port, if that's where this red car's going, but just don't try anything. We'll fight if we have to. I'm not afraid to die."
The tall man sounded frightened and angry at the same time. His yellow-white face looked like a child's about to cry.
"You've convinced me," Hawser grinned. "Now, why not watch out for the red car? 3 wheels, 4 doors, driver, 3 people in the back. Can't miss it."
The tall man bit his lip. Hawser motioned him to look forward with a small movement of the gun.
"That it?"
the bald-headed driver said. Hawser saw the car she meant. It looked right. "Yes, follow it, not too close." The hover dropped back a little. They entered the port area. Cranes and gantries were lit in the distance. Parked road vehicles, hovers, and even light shuttles lay scattered on either side of the road. The car was just ahead now, following a couple of struggling hover buses up a shallow ramp. Their own hover's engine laboured as they climbed. The red car branched off the main route and followed a long curve of roadway, water glittering darkly on either side.
"Are you really Sarble?" Hawser asked the white-haired woman, who still didn't turn to him. "Was that you earlier, outside the hall, or not? Is Sarble really lots of people?"
The people in the car said nothing. Hawser just smiled, watching them carefully, but nodding and smiling to himself. There was silence in the hover, only the wind roaring. The car left the roadway and angled down a fenced boulevard past huge gantries and the lit masses of towering machinery, then sped along a road lined on both sides with dark warehouses. It started to slow by the side of a small dock. "Pull back," Hawser said. The bald-headed woman slowed the hover as the red car cruised by the dockside under the square cages of crane legs. The red car drew up by a brightly lit building. A pattern of lights revolving round the top of the construction spelled out "Sub-Base Access 54" in several languages.
"Fine, stop," Hawser said.
The hover stopped, sinking on its skirts.
"Thanks."
Hawser got out, still facing the man and the white-haired woman.
"You're just lucky you didn't try anything," the man said angrily, nodding sharply, his eyes glistening.
"I know," Hawser said. "Bye now."
He winked at the white-haired woman. She turned and made what he suspected was an obscene gesture with one finger. The hover rose, blasted forward, then skidded round and roared off the way it had come. Hawser looked back at the subplate shaft entrance, where the 3 people who had got out of the car stood silhouetted against the light inside. One of them might have looked back down the dock toward Hawser. He wasn't sure they did, but he shrank back into the shadows of the crane above him. 2 of the people at the access tube went into the building and disappeared. The 3rd person, who might have been Craiklin, walked off toward the side of the dock. Hawser pocketed the gun again and hurried on underneath another crane. A roaring noise, like the one that Sarble's hover had made when it drew away from him, but much louder and deeper, came from inside the dock. Lights and spray filled the sea end of the dock as a huge air cushion vehicle, similar in principle to, but vastly bigger than the hover Hawser had commandeered, swept in from the expanse of black ocean. Lit by starlight, by the glow of the orbital's daylight side arcing overhead and by the craft's own lights, the billows of spray kicked up into the air with a milky luminescence. The big machine lumbered between the walls of the dock, its engines shrieking. Beyond it, out to sea, Hawser could see another couple of clouds, also lit from inside by flashing lights. Fireworks burst from the leading craft as it came slowly up the dock. Hawser could make out an expanse of windows and what appeared to be people dancing inside. He looked back down the dockside. The man he was following was mounting the steps to a footbridge which crossed high over the dock. Hawser ran quietly, ducking behind the legs of cranes and leaping over lengths of thick hawsers. The lights of the hover flashed on the dark superstructure of the cranes. The scream of the jets and impellers echoed between concrete walls. As though pointing out the comparative crudity of the scene, a small craft, dark and silent but for the tearing noise its passage made through the atmosphere, rushed overhead, zooming and disappearing into the night sky, specking once against the loop of the orbital's daytime surface. Hawser gave it a glance, then watched the figure on the small bridge, lit by the flashing lights of the hover still making its lumbering way up the dock underneath. The second craft was just swinging into position outside the dock to follow it. Hawser came to the steps leading to the walkway of the narrow suspension bridge. The man, who walked like Craiglin and wore a grey cloak, was about halfway across. Hawser couldn't see much of what the terrain was like on the other side of the dock, but guessed he stood a good chance of losing his quarry if he let him get to the other side before he started after him. Probably the man, the Craiglin, if it was him, had worked this out. Hawser guessed he knew he was being followed. He set off across the bridge. It swayed slightly underneath him. The noise and lights of the giant hovercraft were almost underneath, the air filled with swirling dark spray kicked up from the shallow water in the dock. The man didn't look round at Hawser, though he must have felt Hawser's footsteps swinging the bridge with his own. The figure left the bridge at the far end. Hawser lost sight of him and started running, the gun out in front of him, the air cushion vehicle beneath, blasting gusts of spray-soaked air about him, soaking him. Loud music blared from the craft, audible even through the scream of the engines. Hawser skidded along the bridge at its end and ran quickly down the spiral steps to the dockside. Something sailed out of the darkness under the spiral of steps and crashed into his face. Immediately afterwards, something slammed into his back and the rear of his skull. He lay on something hard, groggily wondering what had happened, while lights swept over him. The air in his ears roared and roared, and music played somewhere. A bright light shone straight into his eyes, and the hood over his face was thrown back. He heard a gasp. The gasp of a man tearing a hood away from a face only to see his own face staring back at him. Who are you? If that was what it was, then that man was vulnerable now, shocked for just a few seconds. Who am I? He had enough strength to kick up hard with one leg, forcing his arms up at the same time and grabbing some material, his shin connecting with a groin. The man started to go over Hawser's shoulders, heading for the dock. Then Hawser felt his own shoulders grasped, and as the man he held thumped to the ground to one side and behind him, he was pulled over. Over the side of the dock, the man had landed right on the edge and had gone over, taking Hawser with him. They were falling. He was aware of lights, then shadow. The grip he had on the man's cloak or suit, and one hand still on his shoulder. Falling. How deep was the dock? The noise of wind. Listen for the sound of, it was a double impact. He hit water. Then something harder, in a crumpling collision of fluid and body. It was cold, and his neck ached. He was thrashing about, unsure which way was up, and groggy from the blows to his head, then something pulled at him. He punched out, hit something soft, then pulled upright and found himself standing in a little over a meter of water, staggering forward. It was bedlam. Light and sound and spray everywhere, and somebody hanging onto him. Hawser flailed out again. Spray cleared momentarily. And he saw the wall of the dock a couple of meters to his right, and, directly in front of him, the rear of the giant hovercraft, receding slowly, 5 or 6 meters ahead. A powerful gust of oily, fiery air knocked him over, splashing into the water again. The spray closed over him. The hand let go, and he fell back through the water once more, going under. Hawser struggled upright in time to see his adversary heading off through the spray, following the slowly moving hovercraft up the dock. He tried to run, but the water was too deep. He had to force his legs forward in a slow-motion, nightmarish version of a run, angling his torso so that his weight carried him forward. With exaggerated twistings of his body from side to side, he strode after the man in the grey cloak, using his hands like paddles in an attempt to gain speed. His head was reeling. His back, face and neck all hurt terribly, and his vision was blurred, but at least he was still chasing. The man in front seemed more anxious to get away than to stay and fight. The blattering exhaust of the still-moving hover blew another hole in the spray toward the two men, revealing the slab of stern rising above the bulbous wall of the machine's skirt, bowing out from fully 3 meters above the surface of the water in the dock. First the man in front of him, and then Hawser was blown back by the pulse of hot, choking fumes. The water was getting shallower. Hawser found that he could bring his legs out of the water far enough to wade faster. The noise and spray swept over them again, and for a moment Hawser lost sight of his quarry, Then the view ahead was clear, and he could see the big air cushion vehicle on a dry area of concrete. The walls of the dock extended high on either side, but the water and the clouds of spray were almost gone. The man in front staggered to the brief ramp, leading from the now only ankle-deep water onto the concrete, staggered and almost fell, then started running weakly after the hovercraft, now powering faster along the level concrete down the canyon of the dock. Hawser finally splashed out of the water and ran after the man, following the wetly flapping grey cloak. The man stumbled, fell and rolled. As he started to rise, Hawser slammed into him, bowling them both over. He lashed out at the man's face, shadowed in the light coming from behind him, but missed. The man kicked out at Hawser, then tried to get away again. Hawser threw himself at the man's legs, bringing him down once more, the wet cloak flopping over his head. Hawser scrambled over on all fours and rolled him over face up. It was Craiglin. He drew his hand back for a punch. The pale, shaved face underneath him was twisted in terror. Put in shadow by some lights coming from behind Hawser, where another great roaring was... Craiglin screamed, looking not at the man wearing his own real face, but behind him, above him. Hawser whirled round. A black mass blowing spray rushed toward him. Lights blazed high above. A siren sounded, then the crushing black bulk was over him, hitting him, knocking him flat, pounding at his eardrums with noise and pressure, pressing, pressing, pressing. Hawser heard a gurgling sound. He was being rammed into Craiglin's chest. They were both being rubbed into the concrete as though by an immense thumb. Another hovercraft, the second one in the line he'd seen. Abruptly, with a single sweeping stroke of pain, bruising him from feet to head, as if a giant was trying to sweep him up off the floor with a huge hard brush, the weight was lifted off. In its place was utter darkness, noise fit to burst skulls, and violent, turbulent, crushing air pressure. They were under the skirts of the big vehicle. It was right above them, moving slowly forward, or maybe, it was too dark to see anything, stationary over the concrete apron, perhaps about to settle on the concrete, crushing them. As though it was just another part of the maelstrom of battering pain, a blow thudded into Hawser's ear, knocking him sideways in the darkness. He rolled on the rough concrete, pivoting on one elbow as soon as he could and bracing one leg while he struck out with the other in the direction the punch had come from. He felt his foot hit something yielding. He got to his feet, ducking as he thought of whirling impeller blades just overhead. The eddies and vortices of hot oil-filled air rocked him like a small boat bobbing in a chopping sea. He felt like a puppet controlled by a drunk. He staggered forward, his arms out, and hit Craiglin. They started to fall again, and Hawser let go, punching with all his might at the place he guessed the man's head was. His fist crashed into bone, but he didn't know where. He skipped back in case there was a retaliatory kick or punch on its way. His ears were popping, his head felt tight. He could feel his eyes vibrating in their sockets. He thought he was deaf, but he could feel a thudding in his chest and throat, making him breathless, making him choke and gasp. He could make out just a hint of a border of light all around them, as though they were under the middle of the hovercraft. He saw something, just an area of darkness on that border, and lunged at it, swinging his foot from low down. Again he connected, and the dark part of the border disappeared. He was blown off his feet by a crushing downdraft of air and tumbled bodily along the concrete, thumping into Craiglin where he lay on the ground after Hawser's last kick. Another punch hit Hawser on the head, but it was weak and hardly hurt. Hawser felt for and found Craiglin's head. He lifted it and banged it off the concrete, then did it again. Craiglin struggled, but his hands beat uselessly off Hawser's shoulders and chest. The area of lightness beyond the dim shape on the ground was enlarging, coming closer. Hawser banged Craiglin's head against the concrete one more time, then threw himself flat. The rear edge of the skirt scrubbed over him. His ribs ached, and his skull felt as though somebody was standing on it. Then it was over, and they were in the open air. The big craft thundered on, trailing remnants of spray. There was another one 50 meters down the dock and heading toward him. Craiglin was lying still a couple of meters away. Hawser got up onto all fours and crawled over to the other man. He looked down into his eyes, which moved a little. "I'm Hawser! Hawser!" he screamed, but couldn't even hear anything himself. He shook his head, and with a grimace of frustration on the face that was not really his own, and which was the last thing the real Craiglin ever saw, he gripped the head of the man lying on the concrete and twisted it sharply, breaking the neck, just as he had broken Zalin's. He managed to drag the body to the side of the dock just in time to get out of the way of the third and last hovercraft,
Its towering skirt bulged past 2 meters away from where he half lay, half sat, panting and sweating, his back against the cold, wet concrete of the dock, his mouth open and his heart thudding. He undressed Craiklin, took off the cloak and the light-coloured one-piece day suit he wore, then climbed out of his own torn blouse and bloody pantaloons and put on what Craiklin had been wearing. He took the ring Craiklin wore on the small finger of his right hand. He picked at his own hands, at the skin where palm became wrist. It came away cleanly, a layer of skin sloughing off his right hand from wrist to fingertips. He wiped Craiklin's limp, pale right palm on a damp bit of clothing, then put the skin over it, pressing it down hard. He lifted the skin off carefully and positioned it back on his own hand. Then he repeated the operation using his left hand. It was cold, and it seemed to take a very long time and a lot of effort. Eventually, while the three big air cushion vehicles were stopping and letting passengers off half a kilometre down the dock, Hawser finally staggered to a ladder of metal rungs set into the concrete wall of the dock, and with shaking hands and quivering feet, hauled himself to the top. He lay for a while, then got up, climbed the spiral stairs to the small footbridge, staggered across it and down the other side, and entered the circular access building. Brightly dressed and excited people, just off the big hovers and still in a party mood, quietened when they saw him wait near the elevator doors for the capsule, which would take them down to the spaceport area, half a kilometre under their feet. Hawser couldn't hear very much, but he could see their anxious looks, sense the awkwardness he was causing with his battered, bloody face and his ripped, soaking clothes. At last, the elevator appeared. The partygoers piled in, and Hawser, supporting himself on the wall, stumbled in too. Somebody held his arm, helping him, and he nodded thanks. They said something which he heard as a distant rumble. He tried to smile and nod again. The elevator dropped. The underside greeted them with an expanse of what looked like stars. Gradually, Hawser realized it was the light-speckled top of a spacecraft larger than anything he'd ever seen or even heard about before. It had to be the demilitarized culture ship, the Ends of Invention. He didn't care what it was called, as long as he could get aboard and find the cat. The elevator had come to a halt in a transparent tube above a spherical reception area, hanging in hard vacuum, 100 meters under the base of the orbital. From the sphere, walkways and tube tunnels spread out in all directions, heading for the access gantries and open and closed docks of the port area itself. The doors to the closed docks, where ships could be worked on in pressurized conditions, were all open. The open docks themselves, where ships simply moored and airlocks were required, were empty. Replacing them all, directly underneath the spherical reception area, just as it was directly underneath almost the entire port area, was the ex-Culture General Systems vehicle, the Ends of Invention. Its broad, flat top stretched for kilometre after kilometre in all directions, almost totally blocking out the view of space and stars beyond. Instead, its top surface glittered with its own lights where various connections had been made with the access tubes and tunnels of the port. He felt dizzy again, registering the sheer scale of the vast craft. He hadn't seen a GSV before, far less been inside one. He knew of them and what they were for, but only now did he appreciate what an achievement they represented. This one was theoretically no longer part of the culture. He knew it was demilitarized, stripped bare of most equipment, and without the mind, or minds, which would normally run it. But just the structure alone was enough to impress. General systems vehicles were like encapsulated worlds. They were more than just very big spaceships. They were habitats, universities, factories, museums, dockyards, libraries, even mobile exhibition centers. They represented the culture. They were the culture. Almost anything that could be done anywhere in the culture could be done on a GSV. They could make anything the culture was capable of making, contained all the knowledge the culture had ever accumulated, carried or could construct specialized equipment of every imaginable type for every conceivable eventuality, and continually manufactured smaller ships, general contact units, usually warcraft now. Their complements were measured in millions at least. They crewed their offspring ships out of the gradual increase in their own population. Self-contained, self-sufficient, productive and, in peacetime at least, continually exchanging information, they were the culture's ambassadors, its most visible citizens and its technological and intellectual big guns. There was no need to travel from the galactic backwards to some distant culture home planet to be amazed and impressed by the stunning scale and awesome power of the culture.
A GSV could bring the whole lot right up to your front door. Hawser followed the brightly dressed crowd through the bustling reception area. There were a few people in uniform, but they weren't stopping anybody. Hawser felt in a daze, as though he was only a passenger in his own body, and the drunken puppeteer he had felt in the control of earlier was now sobered up a little and guiding him through the crowds of people toward the doors of another elevator. He tried to clear his head by shaking it, but it hurt when he did that. His hearing was coming back very slowly. He looked at his hands, then sloughed the imprinter skin from his palms, rubbing it on each of the lapels of the day suit until it rolled off and fell to the floor of the corridor. When they got off the second elevator, they were in the starship. The people dispersed through broad, pastel-shaded corridors with high ceilings. Hawser looked one way, then another, as the elevator capsule swished back up toward the reception sphere. A small drone floated toward him. It was the size and shape of a standard suit backpack, and Hawser eyed it warily, uncertain whether it was a culture device or not.
"Excuse me, are you all right?" the machine said.
Its voice was robust, but not unfriendly. Hawser could just hear it.
I'm lost, Hawser said too loudly. Lost,
he repeated more quietly, so that he could hardly hear himself. He was aware that he was swaying a little as he stood there, and he could feel water trickling into his boots and dripping off the sodden cloak onto the soft, absorbent surface under his feet.
Where do you want to go?
The drone asked.
To a ship called...
Hawser closed his eyes in weary desperation. He didn't dare give the real name.
The Beggar's Bluff.
The drone was silent for a second, then said,
I'm afraid there is no such craft aboard. Perhaps it is in the port area by itself, not on the ends.
It's an old, Hronish assault ship,
Hawser said tiredly, looking for somewhere to sit down. He spotted some seats set into the wall a few metres away and made his way over there. The drone followed him, lowering itself as he sat, so that it was still at his eye level.
About 100 metres long,
the changer went on, no longer caring if he was giving some sort of game away.
It was being repaired by some port shipbuilders and had some damage to its warping units.
Ah, I think I have the one you want. It's more or less straight down from here. I have no record of its name, but it sounds like the one you want. Can you manage to get there yourself, or shall I take you?
I don't know if I can manage, Hawser said truthfully.
Wait a moment.
The drone stayed, floating silently in front of Hawser for a moment or two. Then it said,
Follow me, then. There is a travel tube just over here and down a deck.
The machine backed off and indicated the direction they should head in by extending a hazy field from its casing. Hawser got up and followed it. They went down a small open AG lift shaft, then crossed a large open area where some of the wheeled and skirted vehicles used on the orbital had been stored.
Just a few examples, the drone explained, for posterity. The ENDS already had a megaship aboard, stored in one of its two general bays, 13 kilometres below in the bottom of the craft.
Hawser didn't know whether to believe the drone or not. On the far side of the hangar, they came to another corridor, and there they entered a cylinder, about 3 metres in diameter and 6 long, which rolled its door closed, flicked to one side, and was instantly sucked into a dark tunnel. Soft lights lit the interior. The drone explained that the windows were blanked out because, unless you were used to it, a capsule's journey through a GSV could be unsettling, due both to its speed and to the suddenness of the changes of direction, which the eye saw but the body didn't feel. Hawser sat down heavily in one of the folding seats in the middle of the capsule, but only for a few seconds.
Here we are, small bay 27492, in case you need it again, in a level S10, right? Goodbye.
The capsule door closed and the machine vanished. He had a brief impression of it flickering past him, but it happened so fast he could have been wrong. Anyway, his vision was still blurred. He looked to his right. Through the walls of the corridor, he looked into clear air. Kilometres of it. There was some sort of roof high above him, with just a suggestion of wispy clouds. A few tiny craft moved. Level with him, far enough away for the view to be both hazy and vast, were hangars. Level after level after level of them. Bays, docks, hangars, call them what you wanted, they filled Hawser's sight for square kilometres, making him dizzy with the sheer scale of it all. His brain did a sort of double take, and he blinked and shook himself, but the view did not go away. Craft moved, lights went on or off. A layer of cloud far below made the view further down still more hazy, and something whizzed by the corridor Hawser stood in. A ship,
fully 300 meters long. The ship passed along the level he was on, swooped, and far, far away did a left turn, banking gracefully in the air to disappear into another bright and vast corridor, which seemed to pass by at right angles to the one Hawser stood staring at. In the other direction, the one that the ship had appeared from, was a wall, seemingly blank. Hawser looked closer and rubbed his eyes. He saw that the wall had an orderly speckle of lights in a grid across it. Thousands and thousands of windows and lights and balconies. Smaller craft flitted about its face, and the dots of travel tube capsules flashed across and up and down. Hawser couldn't take much more. He looked to his left and saw a smooth ramp leading down underneath the tube the capsule travelled in. He stumbled down it into the welcomingly small space of a 200-meter-long small bay. Hawser wanted to cry. The old ship sat on three short legs, square in the centre of the bay. A few bits and pieces of equipment scattered around it. There was nobody else in the bay that Hawser could see, just machinery. The cat looked old and battered, but intact and whole. It appeared that repairs were either finished or not yet started. The main hold lift was down, resting on the smooth white deck of the bay. Hawser went over to it and saw a light ladder leading up into the brightness of the hold itself. A small insect landed briefly on his wrist. He flapped a hand at it as it flew off. How very untidy of the culture, he thought absently, to allow an insect on board one of their sparkling vessels. Still, officially at least, the ends was no longer the culture's. Wearily, he climbed the ladder, hampered by the damp cloak and accompanied by the squelching noises coming from his boots. The hold smelled familiar, though it looked oddly spacious with no shuttle in it. There was nobody about. He went up the stairs from the hold to the accommodation section. He walked along the corridor toward the mess, wondering who was alive, who was dead, what changes had been made, if any. It had only been 3 days, but he felt as though he had been away for years. He was almost at Yalson's cabin when the door was quickly pulled open. Yalson's fair-haired head came out, an expression of surprise, even joy starting to form on it. "Haw?" she said, then stopped, frowned at him, shook her head and muttered something, ducking back into her cabin. Hawser had stopped. He stood there thinking he was glad she was alive, realizing he hadn't been walking properly, not like Craiklin. His tread had sounded like his own instead. A hand appeared from Yalson's door as she pulled on a light robe. Then she came out and stood in the corridor, looking at the man she thought was Craiklin, her hands on her hips. Her lean, hard face looked slightly concerned, but mostly wary. Hawser hid his hand with the missing finger behind his back. "What the hell happened to you?" she said.
"I got in a fight. What does it look like?"
He got the voice right. They stood looking at each other.
"If you want any help," she began.
Hawser shook his head.
"I'll manage."
Yalson nodded, half smiling, looking him up and down.
"Yeah, all right, you manage then."
She jerked a thumb over her shoulder in the direction of the mess. "Your new recruit just brought a gear aboard. She's waiting in the mess, though if you look in now, she might not think it's such a wonderful idea to join up." Hawser nodded. Yalson shrugged, then turned and walked up the corridor through the mess toward the bridge. Hawser followed her.
"Our glorious captain,"
she said to somebody in the room as she went through. Hawser hesitated at Craiklin's cabin door, then went forward to stick his head round the door of the mess. A woman was sitting at the far end of the mess table, her legs crossed over a chair in front of her. The screen was switched on above her as though she had been watching it. It showed a view of a megaship being lifted bodily out of the water by hundreds of small lifter tugs clustered under and around it. They were recognisably antique culture machines. The woman had turned from the sight, though, and was gazing toward Hawser when he looked round the side of the door. She was slim and tall and pale. She looked fit, and her black-coloured eyes were set in a face just starting to show worried surprise at the battered face looking at her from the doorway. She had on a light suit, the helmet of which lay on the table in front of her. A red bandana was tied round her head, below the level of her close-cropped red hair.
"Oh, Captain Craiklin,"
she said, swinging her feet off the seat and leaning forward, her face showing shock and pity.
"What happened?"
Hawser tried to speak, but his throat was dry. He couldn't believe what he saw. His lips worked and he licked them with a dry tongue. The woman started to rise from the table, but he put out one hand and gestured her to stay where she was. She sat slowly back down,
and he managed to say,
I'm all right. See you later. Just stay there.
Then he pushed himself away from the door and stumbled down the corridor to Craiglin's cabin. The ring fitted into the door and it swung open. He almost fell inside. In something like a trance, he closed the door, stood there looking at the far bulkhead for a while, then slowly sat down on the floor. He knew he was still stunned. He knew his vision was still blurred and he wasn't hearing perfectly. He knew it was unlikely, or if it wasn't, then it was very bad news indeed. But he was also sure, absolutely certain. As certain as he had been about Craiglin when he first walked up that ramp to the damage table into the arena. As though he hadn't had enough shocks for one evening, the sight of the woman sitting at the messroom table had all but silenced him and stopped his mind from working. What was he going to do? He couldn't think. The shock was still resounding through his mind. The image seemed stuck behind his eyes. The woman in the messroom was Peristek Balveda.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.